You're turning your back on an entire system, a very convenient system,
yep.
but it is entirely backed by reliance on state power.
Yeah, absolutely. You're not using their money.
Right.
You're not paying for money to go to war contractors. You're not paying for CPS. You're not paying for all of these things that are trappings of a slave society, that we're forced into paying a system that encourages cultural dependence and intergenerational warfare with the welfare state.
Yeah.
We're not paying for our children to be brainwashed and mentally destroyed. So that's the point of not using their money, that you're not buying into that paradigm, you're not supporting it. I don't feel like I'm giving sanction to my exploiters. I'm entering into a new economic system that denies from them spoils that they don't earn, that they don't deserve, and that they employ violence against others to take.
Yeah.
It's an opt-out.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is November 22nd. Oh, my goodness. I'm not goofing around here. I just looked at my calendar at the bottom of my computer, and sure enough, it is the 51st anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Hey, last year we had a fun time doing a research roundtable that lasted about 3 hours. Me and the guys from Tragedy and Hope. You could check that out if you want. It's in our AV club. Or I think Rich eventually released it for free in a mega cast somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 hours long. So either way you want to consume that, it was a very interesting and educational exploration. And this is the 1 year anniversary of that conversation. How about that? Anyway, I'm so sorry. This is part 5 in our Autonomy Through Agorism series, and we are moving beyond permaculture and into the world of alternative currency, namely Bitcoin. I have a very wise, very well-studied guest today named Matthias von Gutenberg. He writes for numerous publications, including Mises.org and EconomicThought.net. And we are going to discuss Bitcoin past, present, and future. And that discussion will be based largely on an article he wrote just a few days ago for Bitcoin Magazine called The Path to Greatness. Now, many of you out there might be saying, wow, Brett, stop the presses. Bitcoin. Why does this hypothetical listener I keep referencing have such a bad attitude? I don't know. But, you know, is this really the right show for you, imaginary listener? We're trying to keep things positive around here. But yeah, I understand that this is not news. I understand that the opportunity to get into Bitcoin on the ground floor, well, those days are long gone. But there's a lot of angles from which we can still explore the world of Bitcoin. And there are plenty of great reasons, both large scale and small scale, for you to enter that world. And I just wanted to point you to a couple other resources. If you're fairly new to this topic, highly recommend Stephanie Murphy's podcast, Let's Talk Bitcoin, which again covers this topic from a variety of angles. Stefan Molyneux did a speech earlier this year called Bitcoin versus Political Power. That's also worth checking out if you're interested in looking at the big picture, how Bitcoin could be used as a form of activism. And if you want to come at it from the other direction, I highly recommend a Tragedy and Hope casual cafe with Richard Grove and Will Pangman, where they talk about the Bitcoin experience for the individual user. And Will addresses a variety of Rich's concerns about this alternative currency. So even if you're fairly well versed in this area, Matthias is so knowledgeable, I still think you can benefit from this conversation. And it is dense. I do want to say, take your time with it. Take it in a couple parts if you need. There is a lot of information in this show, and it was very educational for me. So one more time, totally open to topics or guest suggestions for this series. Please just let me know what other areas of agorism can we explore for you. I'm happy to do it as long as that topic allows us to address the prime objective that I laid out at the beginning of this series. And that is finding more independence in as many areas of life as possible. We are being schooled in this country and around the world to be dependents on the government, but also on a variety of institutions that benefit from the existence of government and the government's application of force. So we are seeking ways around that without making sacrifices in our security or our quality of life. You will not learn that in school. Clap. Here we go. So my guest today on the show is Matthias von Gutenberg. Hey, Matthias.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great, and I'm happy to have you here. Just so people who are unfamiliar know, you have written for Bitcoin Magazine, Mises.org, and EconomicThought.net. And we're going to build most of our conversation today around the subject of Bitcoin, which has actually been pretty neglected on my show since I first heard about it.
That's unfortunate. Well, I'm happy to help talk about it or shed some light a little bit at least.
Well, I think there's a lot of great opportunities for young people with Bitcoin, and it is something that we need to talk about more. I've known about it now for, gosh, like 3 years, and I've said very little.
You're pro then. You're an early adopter at that point, I guess.
Yeah, I haven't made a lot of the best decisions around Bitcoin. I managed to accumulate quite a few of them very early on, and most of them are
foolishly
gone.
Spent them.
Yeah, most of them are gone.
Got scammed out of them one way or another.
So before we get into that, though, I wanted to by the way, we're in my studio, which is, this is rare that I actually get to do a show with a guest in studio.
In-house, as opposed to over Skype?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So, I'm honored to be in the domain of School Sucks Project.
Yes, absolutely. I've only done this very few times, so it's obviously preferable. Tell us a little bit about your background studying economics, first of all, because you were studying economics well before you heard about Bitcoin.
Yeah, correct. So I studied economics formally and informally.
Yeah.
I studied it formally, and I earned a Bachelor of Arts in Economics at Flagler College. It's a little private liberal arts school down in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I spent 4 years studying economics. I was well integrated within the typical framework that the economists generally think in. It's generally a neoclassical framework, or some kind of synthesis between neoclassical ideas and Keynesian ideas, post-Keynesian ideas. I learned all the various models, all the various growth hypotheses, all of the various techniques to take linear regressions of certain data and to extrapolate various predictions out of them, some kind of economic alchemy.
Yeah.
But I also studied economics informally. At the same time, I was reading Human Action. I was reading Man, Economy, and State. I was reading Economics and Ethics of Private Property by Hoppe. I was definitely immersing myself in the economic thought of the Austrian school, particularly with regards to the latter half of the 20th century and some new writers as well. So Stefan Kinsella and Jeffrey Tucker and various others changed my mind on intellectual property, where I had a certain perspective with Mises and with Rothbard. They didn't really give too many words on it, and I had given scant treatment, but some more contemporary authors have, you know, made that the forefront of their thought. So that influenced me as well. And, you know, I remember having discussions with my professors about these subjects, who were themselves kind of conservative free market types.
Yeah.
One of which, Dr. Bradley, I ended up convincing to come back with me to Mises for a week during one of their summer week-long programs.
Wow.
And that was in preparation for him, so he could bone up. He was to teach a course in Austrian economics the following semester.
Yeah, I've talked with quite a few college students who were discovering this stuff. One in particular, a girl, called the show a couple times and just was having a terrible time in college. Once, you know, outside studying the Austrian school, and then inside getting a very different look at what economics is all about.
It's like you have to, especially learning some of the neoclassical and the Keynesian stuff. Economist Frank Knight makes an interesting comment. He remarked once that learning economics from a Keynesian perspective was a lot like watching a trick film in reverse, where all of the like interesting parts or all of the interesting functions happen in precisely the opposite order that you expect them to. And it's difficult to wrap your mind around, because their conception of savings, their conception of investment, their conception of liquidity and time preference and so forth is very different from how Austrians view that, those types of terms, those types of concepts. So learning that academically, formally, having to write 10, 15-page papers on these subjects, while also reading, you know, getting 500 pages into Rothbard's theory of the production process, you know, can be very difficult to maintain those two separate worlds,
yeah,
those two separate frameworks for viewing the same exact picture.
So my audience is obviously familiar with Keynes. Can you talk about neoclassical perspective a little bit? I'm thinking University of Chicago, but I could be wrong.
Sure. So there's tie-ins there.
Yeah.
So the University of Chicago is famous for establishing a school of economic thought, which is more of a it's kind of a free market school, I'd say. They lean towards free market ideas. They're mostly conservatives. The University of Chicago is famous for coining the movement of monetarism, I guess, which was led by Milton Friedman,
yeah.
Which said to kind of set very predictable and stable rules for the central bank to follow under all these circumstances, so they wouldn't have discretionary practices allowed. You know, they were more for like set a rule and leave it,
yeah.
Rather than the Keynesians just like, you know, if you just fiddle with it every 10 years, then we'll be golden. But the neoclassical school is a more broad school, and it starts in the 1870s with. 1890s, perhaps, with Marshall and Hicks, and later in the Keynesian period. But it can be understood by a heavy reliance on mathematical models.
Sure.
A heavy reliance on mathematical symbolism. A heavy reliance on models that are derived from those as well. So whenever you hear someone talk about perfect competition, whenever you see supply and demand curves being drawn and intersected with each other, whenever you hear about optimal growth patterns or utility functions or production functions, production isoquants, all of this stuff is just neoclassical kind of trapping.
Yeah.
It's their attempt to make economics into a physics.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That was actually kind of leads into my next question. Obviously, there's a lot of smart people who are taking, you know, Keynesian economics pretty seriously, you know. And for those of us who are not, you know, too well-versed in these subjects, I mean, like, I certainly understand the basics of both schools of thought. What would you say from your study is, like, the biggest failing of the Keynesian school?
The biggest failing of the Keynesian school? Oh, wow.
Or you can have more than one.
Okay, so one of the failings that I think that they don't recognize is they kind of detach money from its role in building what Hayek describes as the structure of production.
Okay.
So the structure of production is a certain organizational structure in the economy that guides resources to their most value productive ends. So it's usually depicted as a triangle. And so you can think of, like, imagine all of the industries that build things that will be ready in 10 years.
Yeah.
Imagine all of the labs that refurbished microprocessors, or imagine construction companies building homes, or imagine long-term research and development projects. These things that don't pan out for any kind of consumer for about 10 or 15 years. This is what we would call early stage capital goods. Things that take a long time to mature into a final product that can then be sold. Then there's part of the production process that is what we call late-stage capital goods, where you get to, like, almost right at the consumer level. So we're talking about, like, the costs for retailing, like the cost of the building, like hiring the management, stocking the shelves. Like,
yeah.
That's part of the production process, but it's really close to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get much closer than stocking the shelves before the consumer picks it up and buys it, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot closer than 12 years down the line, we're going to start funding this initiative to build this some kind of arcane project that'll pan out in a long time. So the economy is divided by all of these investment projects over various slices of time. There are some investment projects that take a long time to mature. There are some that take a very short period of time to mature. And from the Austrian perspective, that's coordinated through people's savings, through time preference,
mm-hmm.
through the fact that when I'm forward looking, when I want to save for the future, say I have a kid that's, you know, I'm saving for his retirement, you know, his college, or I'm saving for my retirement, or I'm saving for a wedding or whatever,
mm-hmm.
I become forward looking. I take on a different rate of time preference, and that's manifested by the interest rate, and the interest rate coordinates the capital structure. You know, what type of capital projects are going to be built.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a very interconnected body that's connecting the consumers with their savings, with banks and interest rates, and with the capital projects that get built. It's all kind of in harmony.
So obviously the big Austrian criticism of this would be when interest rates start getting manipulated, it screws this process up at multiple places.
Absolutely. You have twisting and turning. You know, when the central bank lowers interest rates artificially, you have consumers who are now disinclined to save because they're earning less savings return on what, you know, if it's 1% as opposed to what you used to earn 5% on your savings,
yeah,
people are disinclined to save. They start consuming more. Whereas, and also in the fact that when the interest rate drops, entrepreneurs now are more able to borrow more cheaply. And so they'll finance projects that they otherwise wouldn't have financed.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it stretches in both ways. You know, there's a tug of war between resources. And at the end, something's got to give. And that's when there's a bust. That's when entrepreneurs have to liquidate their products. They have to fire people.
Yeah.
And normally this boom-bust cycle doesn't create mass unemployment. But with all the labor regulation, all the labor policies, and all of the make-work policies, and all the stuff the government does to make it very difficult to find work, these boom-bust cycles do inevitably create mass unemployment.
Well, yeah, especially if a bunch of jobs are created inside the bubble,
as it's
being blown up by these, you know, false signals.
Precisely.
And then suddenly when it bursts and people look at the aftermath, they're like, wow, you know, a lot of you people are, you know, maybe not intrinsically, but at least in this context, useless.
Yeah. Wasting time on a production process that wasn't sustainable.
Exactly.
That wasn't ultimately profitable. And the Keynesians don't recognize the role that money plays in that kind of process.
Mm-hmm.
The Keynesians, in as much as they think about capital, probably think of it in terms of neoclassical ways of like capital is just one of the ingredients that goes into this black box called a firm and they build products.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
yeah,
like
sure.
this magic box that inputs go in and then finished products come out.
Yeah.
And they don't really get into the entrepreneurial aspect, the capitalistic aspect of having to acquire previous savings in order to build these capital goods. For them, savings and investment, money and capital, these are just kind of disconnected terms that can float on their own. And if you change one variable, it can perturb other ones, but it doesn't have a direct causal relation to the other ones. And it's their view of the economy is much more of like how an engine works.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. If there's like a heavy reliance on mathematical models,
mechanistic.
Then one of the things that's neglected is obviously human behavior. And of course, the Austrians have put a lot of time and thought and study into this as well.
Yeah, indeed.
From there, I wanted to move into what our function is here today. I've been doing a series for some time on agorism, and most of it has really been small scale so far. We talked about permaculture and sustainable living. We were going to move on to talking about intentional communities, you know,
sure.
But this is all very localized. Very, very small. And I realized we haven't talked about buying and selling, you know, outside of state-approved methods. Bitcoin was obviously going to fit into this series one way or another. But the really beautiful thing about this is it's agorism, but it doesn't have to be super local anymore. We're not just talking about, like, you know, bartering with your neighbors or doing things off the grid. Bitcoin allows for agorism globally, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. There's a lot of parallels people make with Bitcoin to other technologies, and one that may be relevant now is that in the way that if you imagine like hundreds of years ago when there were certain books that were banned and they had to be like copied by hand and physically distributed to other people locally so that the ideas could be kept alive, right? The advent of the internet and specifically the advent of like decentralized file sharing networks really make that impossible to stop.
Yeah.
Right? They make something that was local, right? Printing off a Bible on your own little press and distributing it in your own language and, you know, giving the finger to the Catholic Church, right? This is Johann Gutenberg,
mm-hmm.
some 70 years ago, something like that. But now, you know, now that was just local, of course, right? He was just stirring little Lutheran sentiment, little Protestant sentiment, you know, in Germany at the time. But if you look at things like the Pirate Bay, you know, world's largest library, free library, that's file sharing that is unmitigated, that is global in scale. And so that kind of parallel works with Bitcoin as well. So where you had to buy and sell locally, you had to trade in things like gold or silver, where there was people had a small kind of network effect in their little community. Everyone would take a little barter script or gold or silver or something like that, company script perhaps sometimes. Now with Bitcoin, you can do that on an international scale, on a global scale. You have the same advantage of being able to circumvent prohibitions on exchange. And those could be flat out prohibitions, as in like this currency is illegal, as in I think the case in either Ecuador and Bolivia.
Mm-hmm.
It could be indirect prohibitions where the government levies legal tender laws on certain currencies and they discourage other currencies with capital gains taxes. So it's they nudge you in certain directions to use their own favorite currency or things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
all of those kind of just get washed away like a sandcastle coming on a high tide with Bitcoin.
Right.
It's the great equalizer. It allows a Bangladeshi, it allows a Bolivian, it allows a Swede or an Egyptian or a New Zealander or an American the same access to international finance markets, to global finance markets, and to just regular markets. I'm not just talking about trading on Forex markets and having financial derivatives backed off Bitcoin, although that's certainly possible. But just the real things like buying cell phone minutes, buying food for your family, buying electricity, buying entertainment, being able to market yourself, being able to sell your own product. You know, 10, 15 years ago, it wasn't possible, or at least not economically feasible to the same extent it is now, to upload your content on the internet, original content such as that you do, School Sucks Project, monetize it, ask for donations in a natively digital currency that resides purely on the internet, that was born from the internet, and to make a living off of that. You are entering into a division of labor that otherwise wouldn't be possible.
Yeah.
You'd have to be doing something else. You'd have to earn some income some other way and keep this as a side project or keeping it as a little, a thing you do once a week or whatever. But with Bitcoin, I don't know if that's your plans, but theoretically you can monetize it. You know, there are women in Afghanistan that are forming their own kind of clothing cooperatives, clothing operations, and they're funded by Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And it's giving them freedom that they've never experienced before.
So just as, if I was trying to do this 20 years ago, maybe I'd have access to a couple hundred people, right?
Yeah.
That would be it.
If you could get your own kind of recording studio, if you could hire your own studio, if you could get your own equipment that was inexpensive, if you could. So all of the huge capital costs that go with that shrank enormously in 20 years.
Oh, yeah. So that's actually leading to my next question, or it's related to my next question. And that would have been impossible. Right. So we're just talking about the same operating budget that I have now. I could have gotten a typewriter, plenty of paper, some envelopes, some stamps, some address lists from some marketing company in the area. And I could have done a newsletter and maybe reached a couple hundred people. And that would have been it. But obviously now I can reach thousands and thousands of thousands of people. But on the other side, when people are looking now at all of the options they have available through using this digital currency, I would think that we would start to see the prices of goods. Like you used in one of your articles that I read, you used toothpaste as an example, like buying toothpaste from Japan, mm-hmm. right? If you have the entire globe open to you now as a market, we should see prices come down, right? Significantly.
Yeah.
In a lot of goods.
Yeah, indeed. So that's one of the factors that's at play when you integrate, when you introduce something like Bitcoin on the global scene, because prior to Bitcoin, BC or BBC, ABC, I don't know, before or after Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But before Bitcoin, you have essentially these regional markets that are segregated from each other by various fiat monies, by various jurisdictional monies. The dollar currently and in the past has enjoyed widespread usage, but that is unique among countries in the world. Many other countries, currency is not accepted in many other countries. There's a lot of limited involvement. Just one statistic, I really don't like statistics, but it helps to paint the picture that currently on the Forex markets every single day, the United States dollar is on 87% of one side of the exchange.
Wow. Now explain that for people who might not understand.
So the Forex market is a foreign exchange market. We exchange currencies.
Yeah.
And what every currency is exchanged into, 87% of the time, it's United States dollar.
Okay.
So only 13% of the time are trades in the Forex market conducted in non-US dollar currencies, like a ruble into a hei, or a peso into a euro or yen or something like that.
Sure. Okay.
Almost 9 out of 10 times it's done with a dollar as an intermediary. So that enjoys pretty widespread usage, pretty wide network effects. For other reasons, I think it'll fall. But what you mentioned earlier about prices deflating, you're connecting all those markets now. Mm-hmm. So now you don't only have 10 or a dozen or 50 options in which you can buy this type of product or this range of products. Now you've got literally thousands.
Yeah.
Now you've got the whole world as Etsy. Now you've got the whole world as eBay. Now you've got the whole world as Thingiverse for 3D printing, if there's 3D printing fans out there. You've got an enormous buffet line of all these different products and all these different people and all these different entertainers and all these different ideas and all these different configurations of these products that you like to use. It's very daunting. There's a lot more options now than people were used to before. They were locked. Locked into their own little way of doing stuff, and what currency could I exchange? And if you didn't have a brokerage account that could trade other currencies, you couldn't buy in those countries, and all types of little restrictions and all types of capital controls and all that nonsense. With Bitcoin, there's many factors going into it at once. So the fact that we're now introducing the world into a global economy is one factor of many. So that one factor will lead to lower prices because now you're increasing the available supply of goods, and you're increasing the availability of other people to demand those goods.
Yeah, competition. Absolutely.
Indeed. But the fact that Bitcoin is also limited in its units, that it's mathematically scarce, implies that as it gets more and more accepted, the units themselves will fetch a higher market price.
Exactly. Like what should have happened with the dollar if it had been tied to
something
of value. Yeah,
right. With gold, we find what's called secular deflation. And the most prosperous period in the United States, in the history of the United States, takes place between the years, I think, 1871 and 1891.
Yeah.
About two decades when we were on a gold standard. We were on gold standard before and after, but it was a gold standard that saw falling prices for nearly everything. And it was during that period of time that America really changed from an agricultural nation that had just come out of a civil war into this kind of industrial powerhouse of the Gilded Age that's able to fight with Spain and Cuba, that's able to invade the Philippines, that's able to create a presence in World War One, that's able to craft global diplomatic policy for 80 years thereafter, right? It was kind of during this span of maybe two or three decades or so that workers saw their real wages shoot up enormously, that prices of goods were falling in those terms. And that was under a gold standard. And it was just because of the fact that gold is geologically difficult to acquire that makes it so. But that focus will end up being pronounced even more so in Bitcoin.
Yeah.
There are no future asteroids that you can mine Bitcoin from. There's no fusion you can do to create more Bitcoin, as there may be with gold in the future at some point. So that's another effect. You know, if Bitcoin were just like infinite in units, if there were no cap, right? I think Dogecoin similar. If there's just like no cap to the coins, you can just have a block cycle every once in a while and it creates new coins all the time. You would still see deflation because all the markets are coming together, and you have this influx of supply and this influx of demand. But the deflation is now even more pronounced because what's bringing the whole world together is itself scarce. So there's effects upon effects. I don't know if you ever took any kind of mathematics around the calculus level, but what we'd call in mathematics a system of simultaneous equations, where you have you have equations simultaneously layered on one another, and you have to solve all of them simultaneously to reach kind of an effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a similar process with looking at all these different economic effects. You know, we can look at the fact that all the markets are coming together into one currency, which has deflationary tendencies. In the second place, the currency itself is scarce and limited, which has deflationary tendencies. It's factually superior to other currencies out there that are managed by government stewards or that are precious metal based.
Mm-hmm.
And so this will inspire people over time to adopt it. And as they do so, they won't be able to find Bitcoin at the prices that it used to be.
Yeah, yeah.
So
for the people in my audience who don't know, this is an important question. It's a simple question, I think. Well, maybe it's not a simple question. Maybe it's a simple question. Maybe it doesn't have a simple answer. Why is there a cap to the amount of Bitcoin that could ever exist, for those who don't understand it, that there's essentially a final, I guess you could call it a market capitalization for the number of Bitcoin, right? Yeah. Why is that?
Well, the supply of Bitcoin is designed to be scarce so that it mimics the deflationary tendencies of gold, I guess,
okay,
is one answer. So the idea of mining for Bitcoin and how mining operates is that you're contributing your CPU cycles of your computer to this large network that's trying to find extremely small numbers and this kind of magic hat. And the more power that you add to it, the program automatically adjusts the difficulty of getting the Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So it's supposed to resemble gold mining in the fact that it becomes harder to do over time.
Okay, yeah.
Whereas when there were, you know, gold panners in California in 1849, they could take a pan into the river and shake it, and there was gold in their pan. You know, they find little nuggets of gold. At some point, that becomes exhausted, and you have to have specialized machinery to go into the mines, and have, you know, pickaxes and shovels, and then even more specialized machinery like drills and various, you know, gigantic drills and even bigger drills and so forth.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so that's kind of the tendency That was the idea of how Bitcoin mining should operate. The reason it's limited is because that's what inspires the initial valuation. That's why anyone cares to hold on to Bitcoin even in the first place.
Yeah.
So if I understood that there was some money out there, some digital money that solved some interesting computer science problems, and that that enables this kind of exchange to happen, you know, easily and cheaply and in a more or less private fashion and so forth, that'd be interesting. But them being scarce is what gives individual users that desire to hold on to this chunk, because they know it's this chunk of the Bitcoin, of the whole Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Right? I sometimes refer to Bitcoin, I think of it in terms of land, and that when you own one Bitcoin, you're owning 1/21,000,000th of all Bitcoins.
Yeah. Okay.
So in the same way that land is scarce, you know, when I send you Bitcoin, I'm chopping up a Bitcoin. Usually, it's usually not a whole, unless I mined it myself. It's usually not a whole Bitcoin. It's a bunch of chopped other Bitcoin outputs from other people that I've received, and I'm sending that to you. And that's kind of like little parcels of land that kind of just get aggregated together, and then you receive that total.
So this is just something that for somebody who is knowledgeable on this, they could see it in a code. That there's no alchemy, if you will, possible in this respect.
Right? So
there's never going to be a day that comes where someone says, surprise, there's 42 million
correct.
Bitcoin.
Right. It removes trust from the equation.
Okay.
It removes the idea that there's going to be some central founder is going to come back and change the rules at the 11th hour. It reduces the fear that malevolent conspirators can somehow take over, or that the people who manage the Bitcoin central bank can be bought and sold and do this for ulterior motives or whatever. By having it hard-coded into the program, there's no dispute.
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not, it's got 21 million potential units. Use a different coin if you want unlimited coins to be printed. If you want to lose purchasing power with the coins as long as you hold them, use Freightcoin.
Yeah.
If you want to take on someone's IOU in a web of trust-based system, get Ripple, get XRP. If you want a money that is, you know, highly inflationary, get Dogecoin. There's various different coins out there. With Bitcoin, it was, you know, intended to be, as I understand it, and the purpose that I can discern from its use, that it was supposed to be strictly scarce so as to give people a reason to want to buy into it in the first place.
Yeah.
If I know that I'm buying into a couple units, what are a couple nominal units? I've got, you know, what's more, 10 Bitcoin or 10,000 Dogecoin? The nominal units doesn't matter. It's how much of that is relative to the total pie.
Okay.
What's the percentage of all the assets that I currently own? And that's going to help me understand why I should even place value on this thing at all. If I've got 10,000 Dogecoin and there's only 20,000 ever made, that's a lot. I'm fabulously wealthy as far as the Dogecoin community is concerned, right?
Yeah.
But if there's 10 billion possibly could be made, 10,000 is nothing. It's a penny that I find in the street. I should just kick it in the sidewalk and forget I ever saw it.
And let's just contrast that with, you know, the world in which we currently live and our parents grew up in and our grandparents grew up in, where maybe you have some nice old lady who's got 60,000 Federal Reserve notes in the bank. Meanwhile, the printing presses are running.
Yeah.
And, you know, she, even if she thought in those terms, like, my $60,000 is X percent of the total available Federal Reserve notes,
yeah,
which she probably would never say to herself, that percentage is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the way you explained it was actually really helpful. And I do want to transition from there into this world of fiat currency, because we're doing this series on agorism, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things that people have said in this series is that agorism is not necessarily activism. It can be, but that's not really its purpose, right? It's more of a individual pursuit. It's more about protection and individual or family planning.
Making ends meet.
Right. It's not necessarily a form of activism, but it can be.
Mm-hmm.
So with Bitcoin, when we contrast this to the world of the 20th century and we saw what happened with, you know, fiat currency, especially after 1912 and the 1913 and the founding of the Federal Reserve, I wanted to bring that up because when we were talking about this great boom period of the United States when they were on the gold standard, one of the things you mentioned was the ability of the U.S. government, because of a strong economic period, to project military power, it seems, further out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe that was ancillary to the government, but that really doesn't take off until we have this fractional reserve banking, right? As far as the power projection and the, you know, imperialism.
That's true. So it's a point that's made in certain libertarian circles that the smaller the state you start off with, the more belligerent it will end up becoming later.
Yeah.
Because it's able to feed off of a wealthy and productive body of hosts.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there's a reason that North Korea can't afford anything better than tanks from 1963 Soviet Russia.
Right.
Or airplanes, you know, jet fighters from 1970s, Iran or something like that.
Yeah.
It's because they don't have very productive people.
Yeah.
And so you can see, so that's kind of a tyranny, but it's kind of a tyranny stuck in time.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like a feudal society that's not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
They're exploiting the hell out of those people, and it's deplorable and it's awful, of course, but they're not advancing. It's not like it's not like they're developing new technologies that's going to spread their despotism anywhere else. Nobody else in the world really wants to go down to that level, that standard of living, to, you know, what the North Koreans currently enjoy. But it's true, a transition into fiat money gives the government, it removes the restrictions on the government's war-making abilities.
Mm-hmm.
Because while it's true that the government benefits indirectly from an economy on a gold standard, or an economy that's mostly liberalized, or economy that's free, or however you want to describe it, they benefit much more directly from the ability to create money, from the ability to legislate rules of the game, the ability to borrow at cheap interest from their friends to make special deals. They suddenly have, suddenly financiers and suddenly war contractors are now much more relevant in the day-to-day lives with the high executives of the state than they were under a gold standard. So it's true. Ron Paul makes the comment that the century of it's no coincidence that the century of total war coincided with the century of total fiat banking, total
right.
central banking.
Yeah.
And so this is where Bitcoin can kind of shatter this paradigm, because the war-making capabilities of the United States government are purely dependent on its ability to produce its money.
Yes.
And to produce its money and to have others buy it and have others buy treasury bonds. At this point, usually it's just been the Federal Reserve with the quantitative easing process.
Yeah.
Japanese and Chinese are not as interested in buying government debt from the U.S. as they had been a couple of years ago. We'll see where that goes, if there's going to be some pop in international markets. But with Bitcoin, it allows the exchange of value not only more easily, not only less expensively, just in terms of the kind of transaction costs that are involved with making change or storing money or assaying gold or something like that. These are transaction costs, right? You know, to do business in silver, I have to ship it somewhere, I have to insure it, I have to store it, all these things.
Yeah, right.
And with dollars, they can print a million of them. I have to trust the bank, and the bank has to trust the settlement company, and the settlement company has to trust the lawyers, and the lawyers have to trust the regulatory bodies, and the regulatory bodies get their jobs from the government. There's all this kind of very intricate hierarchical process that each party kind of is mutually incentivized to take care of each other, but they're all in this long kind of, they're all kind of shackled together.
Yeah.
And with Bitcoin, you don't have to deal with any of that. You can just forget it. You can use a different money. You can use a digital money that, as I said earlier, is not only easier and cheaper and more secure and more transparent, while at the same time being a more private currency. It also doesn't have anything to do with the government. It doesn't have anything to do with central banks. It doesn't have anything to do with Bilderberg or with Bohemian Grove or Newt Gingrich. It doesn't have anything to do with any of these people or any of these things.
Yeah.
It's a digital currency that nobody owns, that nobody maintains. And yet everybody owns it and everybody maintains it. But nobody has discretionary power over it. Nobody can decide that the computer isn't behaving correctly and they're going to change some numbers. Nobody has access to the ledger in that way. While everyone has access to the ledger, it's open.
Yeah.
So Bitcoin is kind of strange. It upends the typical notions of money and banking. It forces you to learn a little bit about the value of open source software. It forces you to learn a little bit about the value of peer-to-peer networking.
Right.
Because that's where Bitcoin's value proposition lies. If it was just some digital money, why use Bitcoin over PayPal?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Well, one of them, you know, is a central authority that can be corrupted and bought and or arrested or put out of business or raided and their servers can go down or whatever. And the other is a money that's supported by a worldwide network on a peer-to-peer platform where all nodes are the same nodes. You know, there's a line in Orwell's Animal Farm when Napoleon is recounting to one of the cows, I think, he's explaining that we're all equal. Some of us are just more equal than others.
Yeah.
That's not true with Bitcoin. Every node in Bitcoin is equal.
Yeah.
And they either contribute hashing power to support the network or they don't. They sign transactions or they don't. They spend Bitcoin or they don't. Whatever. There's no central party to coordinate all of it. It's just kind of spontaneous.
So you brought up so many great things there. And first of all, I wanted to talk about, well, no, I actually want to conclude with, but I'll preview now, all of the other things that this technology can be used and probably will be used to do in the future. Like a medium of exchange is really just the first step for this technology.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing is you wrote a piece for Bitcoin Magazine just a few days ago, and it was called Destined for Greatness, right?
The Path to Greatness.
Path to Greatness, I'm sorry. Yep. And you used this Pac-Man analogy that you kind of hinted at when you were talking there. Like, obviously, right now, if I want gas, if I want a bag of chips, I'm using either Federal Reserve notes or a credit card.
Credit card, yeah.
And those are the options I have because that's the world that's set up. So you go through this process of describing how Bitcoin will grow, and I wanted to go through that together. I kind of think of it, too, as like a snowball rolling down the hill, and the increasing size is its obviously legitimacy, perceived legitimacy, and acceptance as time goes by. So we're here now, or maybe we're not at the beginning, but what happens first in this Pac-Man analogy of yours?
Well, the first thing that happens, I think, will be that I mean, Bitcoin already beats out every other altcoin by market capitalization by orders of magnitude.
Right.
Bitcoin is something like 95, 96% of the entire cryptocurrency market cap. If you add up the value of all the other altcoins, all the other Litecoins and the Darkcoins and the Dogecoins and all the other stuff, Bitcoin is overwhelmingly the heavyweight champion of the cryptocurrency market.
So this is like what Eric Voorhees and others have said, that it's Bitcoin. You know, as far as all the coins go, Bitcoin won. Now, do you think these other ones will eventually just fade away?
They may. I think that some of them, or a lot of them, will serve as very useful laboratories for what features or what functions may be interested in a cryptocurrency. How does this type of hash algorithm operate? How safe is it? How does this feature work? Can we integrate this in a future Bitcoin patch?
Yeah.
But I don't think that all the altcoins that exist deserve to have market value.
Okay, sure.
I think that a lot of people that attach market value to some of these coins are kind of being romantic about their investment, their little project. And I've had people at Porkfest that talk to me about getting into this coin or this coin, you got to try. It's had this many, it's this price already, and here's the statistics, here's the dynamics. And it's similar to Bitcoin, and it has certain features that Bitcoin doesn't have or something like that. But it doesn't have the network effect. It doesn't have the enormous body of millions of people that already use it. So there already are millions of people that use Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I think we're already at maybe four or five million, something like that.
Yep.
But, you know, compare that with the amount of people that use NXT or that use Litecoin or something like that, and we're talking about significantly smaller network effects. So just immediately, it's just not immediately plausible to me, unless there's a substantial value proposition, like this coin does something if there were a coin like Zerocoin that were perfectly anonymous, had some kind of amazing technical value proposition, then I could see a role for it. But otherwise, they're not useful as media of exchange. They're not useful. They're useful as laboratories. They're useful as social icons. Like Dogecoin bears social status when people use Dogecoin.
Yeah.
Like it's funny. Yeah. And there's a kind of a giving community and they're kind of generous and they have their own little vocabulary and their own vernacular and their own little, you know, their own little friends, their own little subreddit, of course.
Yeah.
But it's not useful as a medium of exchange. I would never choose to use Dogecoin as a medium of exchange over Bitcoin, other things being equal. It's useful just for a status effect. It's useful because it's funny, because the Shiba looks cool and, you know, it's on a car. It was racing at Talladega, and that's funny. So I think the first thing that Bitcoin will eat in this kind of extended metaphor is these kind of perhaps not irrelevant but non-necessary media of exchange, like other various altcoins that don't serve any higher purpose, that don't have any advantage over Bitcoin.
Okay, so that's step one, and then what does it eat next?
The next step is going to be breaking into the credit card markets.
Okay.
It's going to be establishing total dominance over online payments.
Yeah.
Bitcoin is the natively secure online payment system, and it's many more things than that, but that's what it will be increasingly used at in this country, in America at least. And that will start to eat into the profit margins and start eating into the business that Visa and MasterCard and Amex currently enjoy.
Right.
And the ability to save on transaction costs, the ability to not pay 2 to 3% for credit card fraud because you accept Visa at your store, will push business owners and will push entrepreneurs to look more carefully at Bitcoin in a brick and mortar setting.
Okay, yeah. So there might be one smaller bite along the way too, where Bitcoin is starting to get more and more acceptance for e-commerce.
Yeah, indeed. Right. Right.
So I know, and this might be useful information to my audience, Overstock.com accepts Bitcoin. I was trying to figure out how to buy plane tickets with Bitcoin.
Mm. Cheap Air.
Cheap Air?
I think Cheap Air does Bitcoin, yeah.
I might look into that again. And I don't know how far away sites like Amazon and eBay are. I know there's like, you know, a couple of steps you can take through sites like Gift.
Correct. Yeah.
Right? Where you can go and spend Bitcoin to basically get
Amazon gift cards.
Amazon gift cards.
Yeah. I saved 3% by doing that. So Gift gives you a 3% discount when you buy with Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
So if you spend $97 in Bitcoin, you can buy a $100 Amazon gift card.
Yeah.
The kind of equivalent.
So because e-commerce is becoming a larger and larger part of the economy,
yeah,
really, and has been for, you know, almost two decades now,
yep,
growing, it's certainly more significant all the time as a share of the whole economy, then sooner or later, what you're saying about, you know, credit cards is brick and mortar is going to have to say, well, okay, if it's that easy to purchase things online, how can we be competitive?
Right.
And I think it would start with larger operations like Target. I know that, right, I've seen people just hold their phone up at Target with some kind of gift card that was purchased with Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And
it scans no problem, yeah, and their POS can, you know, integrate it no problem, and it just, yeah, it functions like any other kind of tender. One thing that I want to mention to tie into the episodes in agorism theme,
yeah,
or what was it earlier?
Autonomy through agorism.
Autonomy
we call
through
this series.
I was thinking adventures in agorism. is that Bitcoin? You know, its homeland is the internet.
Yeah,
right. That's its territory, right? That's its street corner that it defends is the internet.
Yeah.
But Bitcoin will also make enormous strides in what we call the worldwide agorist network, what economists call System D. And System D is French. Don't ask me to explain or pronounce, but it essentially refers to the whole constellation of economic transactions that take place outside of official government sanction and surveillance. So it's all of the kiosk peddlers that are selling fish in Rio de Janeiro. It's all of the squatters in Cairo and Egypt that are getting paid $5 to do this or that good. It's all the unregistered, you know, vendors. It's all of the unregistered car mechanics, all the unregistered engineers, or all of the unregistered, you know, people that work in stores and various things. If you travel outside of the United States, and I'm sure you've traveled outside of the country a little,
mm-hmm,
bit.
Yep.
You travel to places like Brazil, you travel to Argentina, you travel to Italy, and you see the men from Senegal with their, you know, hawking their wares on the street. That's all agorism. None,
yeah,
of them have licenses.
Right.
None of them have papers. None of them have, you know, socialist security numbers.
Yeah.
Or if they do, they forgot them, I guess.
Right.
But, and there's a good book by, I think his name is Hernando de Soto. It's called Mystery of Capital, Why Capitalism Works in the West and Fails Everywhere Else.
Yeah.
And he basically looks at the kind of regulatory structure in many countries around the world where it takes 180 days to start a business or something, or it takes $40,000 to do, you know, some kind of have a wedding or some kind of outrageously expensive or outrageously prohibitive in terms of time, in terms of all the forms, all the bureaucrats you have to talk to, all of the things in triplicate you have to get done. It takes months and months and months for all the stuff, and that prohibits people from engaging in international credit markets.
Okay.
Because if you need the state to issue you property title to your home, you know, maybe everyone around you knows you own the home, but if you can't leverage that internationally as an asset, if you can't get your knee in the door, then you have no credit. You can't access the rest of the world. You're stuck in your little paradigm in Venezuela. You're stuck in your little economy in Peru. So these governments are notoriously bad at not being efficient at defining and giving these people property title to their homes. They make it very difficult to start businesses. They make it very difficult to earn a living with all the high tax rates, and this drives people into agorism, not because they have an ideological axe to grind, but because they need to make ends meet. they live in the favelas, and they need to sell this food to get this money to pay this man so their family is safe. They need to make a business. They need to earn money to get out of the grinding poverty they're in. But the state makes it so hard.
You know, I remember hearing about this. I was studying up for a show on East Germany. And I was listening to interviews with people who survived living in East Germany in the early 1980s.
Yeah.
And this is what they said. They said there was a huge counter economy. They didn't call it that, but they said, yeah, we would, you know, barter and, yeah. you know, trade time for things.
Scrip or labor or whatever.
Yeah. But so it's interesting here. It's not just us who are doing that here. I mean, I remember before I knew any of this stuff, like what an asset it was in the employment world to find somebody who would pay you under the table.
Yeah.
Like I used to, when I started teaching. So even when I was totally on the books as a W-2 employee, when summer came, I would shop around because everyone's hiring painters. And I would usually pick someone who could pay me under the table.
How do you approach someone with a question like that? How do you discern who will or who will not pay you under the table?
You just ask. I mean, but see, that's what I'm saying. It's it's almost accepted in that world. And you know, I'm talking like when I first started doing this was the first year I was a teacher with the summers off, 2004. So, you know, 10 years ago, it was a different world, right? Because I would say, yeah, I pay under the table. Yeah, no problem. Yeah. And so 3 years after that, it's like, oh no, that's getting too hard. They're onto us, you know? So it changed very quickly.
Yeah.
But I remember it being much easier to find somebody who would do it. It was almost like if you were just like what would be considered a laborer. I mean, painting is a little bit more of a skill than just like pushing a wheelbarrow around. But most of those jobs that were done by contractors or subcontractors, they didn't want to go through all that paperwork to have you work there. If they could get away with it, they'd just pay you under the table.
Pay
but those
cash.
Days are over now, I think. Yeah.
Well, Bitcoin's bringing those days back.
Yeah.
Because now all that you need is any kind of technology that can send and receive those transmissions.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you don't have a laptop or a computer, people will object that, well, people in Africa don't have desktop computers or big mining rigs or anything like that. They seem to miss the point that countries that are what people would describe as third world nations or less developed nations or that don't have the same kind of capital infrastructure that the West has, they leapfrog innovation.
Mm-hmm.
The people of Africa didn't get into desktop computing. That's too much. It's too capital intensive to have that kind of industry. What they did get into was cell phones. So there aren't that many landlines in Africa, not that many desktop computers in Africa, but almost every single soul on that continent has some kind of a phone. It's probably a Nokia feature phone, the most popular phone in the world.
Yeah.
And they can send SMS and they can call and they can, you know, they can, some of them can access the internet. And that's all you really need. So there's companies like Coinapult that have integrated Bitcoin payments and invoices through SMS, through email.
Yeah.
So you don't even need to have the Bitcoin software by itself. If you can receive text messages, if you can receive SMS, then you can receive Bitcoin. And that's huge. That's huge for people that don't have ready access to the internet. They have sporadic, perhaps, access to the internet, or it's controlled by the Egypt of, you know, or the government of Egypt.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
But, you know, you see all these innovations, like Mozilla is pushing out a $35 smartphone that can access the internet, that can access a browser, that can have, you know, up and down some kind of dedicated, I don't know if it's 3G, but some kind of dedicated up and down, upload and download. That's absolutely possible, and that's well within a budget of, you know, a family, or that's much more economical than $400 smartphone that we get today, you know, my Motorola Droid or an iPhone 6 or something like that.
Right.
You have the bare bones. You have the most minimum kind of technology that's feasible for these things. And suddenly you've got everyone has all the infrastructure they need for this new economy.
Right.
You know, in Kenya and in Nairobi and in Nigeria, they're trading cell phone minutes.
Right? Yeah,
they're working on something called M-Pesa. M-Pesa is a single company that sells cell phone service, and people will trade minutes of M-Pesa to each other as a currency. It's quite a thriving barter economy, and some company has integrated Bitcoin into that. They're calling it BitPesa. You can send Bitcoin over the same type of network, and there's inroads into all of that. So when I said that Bitcoin is most comfortable online in the digital sphere, it'll take over e-commerce. Yes, that's true, but it'll also take over meat space, where credit facilities are weak, where lending channels are hampered, where the fiat money is, you know, dangerously redlining to inflation like in Argentina.
Sure.
These places as well, you will see heavy adoption, physical, in person, of Bitcoin and people trading Bitcoin there. So, you know, people talk to me about the United States and Superintendent Benjamin Losky of the New York Division of Financial Services Regulatory Board and all this stuff. And I don't, you know, I don't really follow all of that because it's not relevant to me. It's like people still think in outdated terms, like what will happen to the U.S. when Bitcoin gets adopted, as if it's like it's like a line in the sand. Before this, you're not adopted. After this, you're mainstream adopted. It's like a dichotomy they have. It's just the wrong way to think about it. This would be equivalent to someone asking 15 years ago, you know, which telecom company is going to be the first to accept the internet?
Right, right.
And they'd be like, they all will?
Yeah.
You don't, it doesn't work that way. It's not like AT&T is going to stake out this ground and, you know, who are the other competitors back then? I don't know. Like some, you know, GE or Nokia, whatever. I'm going to stake out this ground.
Sure.
It's like, no, you're all going to be a part of it, whether you like it or not. It's just going to have a matter of how well you adjust to it, how quickly you adjust to it, if you're ready for it, or if you fight it. If you want to try to outlaw it or ban it or prevent other people from using it, you will be left behind.
Absolutely. So let's chomp along with our Pac-Man metaphor there.
Yeah.
We've gotten to Bitcoin essentially taking over these traditional and often outdated methods of payment, like using credit cards online has not traditionally been the safest thing to do.
They were never supposed to ever touch each other.
Yeah. I mean, credit cards go back, I think, to the 40s.
Yeah.
I was doing trivia on my show recently. The first credit card was used in Brooklyn in like 1946 or 1947.
Right after the war.
Yeah. So this kind of also goes back to what I was saying about agorism is not activism, right? It doesn't have to be, but if there's enough people who are using Bitcoin to help themselves, whether they're, you know, here in the United States or in some place that's arguably worse economically, where there's even tighter restrictions on, you know, how people can behave economically, that is eventually going to scale up to central banks, right?
Yeah.
And governments themselves.
Indeed. So what's really fascinating for me, coming from an economics background, is that we like to discuss money and think about money and how the origins of money and what good money is and what bad money is. But so rarely do we get to witness a money emerging into the market that's not from state fiat.
Yeah.
That's not from central decree. That's not from we're gonna eliminate the Deutschmark and you're gonna get the euro now.
Right.
We're gonna eliminate the pound and you're gonna get this.
Yeah.
Sterling, right?
Right.
This is like a money that some mad scientist created by himself and then disappeared. And right, no one's heard from him, or very infrequently have heard from him since. And people are looking at it and they realize it and they get the foresight in their head and they thought, oh my God, this can actually be better than what we currently use. And then so someone else adopts it. Someone else brings it into their cash holding. Someone else starts to incorporate it into their savings plans or incorporate it into their payment plans.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I pay Bitcoin. I use Bitcoin to pay rent. I use it to pay for food and some groceries. I use it to pay for membership at a club. I use Bitcoin for exercise. There's a rock climbing facility in Manchester that takes Bitcoin. It's Vertical Dreams.
Yep.
I get paid in Bitcoin for some of my projects that I do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's already factored into my own type of economic calculation.
Right.
I hold a certain amount of Bitcoin and I understand what that value is and I incorporate it with the other cash holdings. It's like if I were holding dollars and holding rubies and holding yen and holding bushels of wheat, it's like each one of them would kind of factor into my kind of calculation as assets.
Right. Yeah.
But what's fascinating is that Bitcoin is a money that except for a very few people, nobody really anticipated this happening, this emerging. You know, so Bitcoin solves these financial problems we discussed earlier with the trust and the intermediaries, but fundamentally it's a computer science problem. And the problem is, how do you establish trust on an untrusted network?
Right.
And that's what the blockchain solves. The blockchain forces everyone to have consensus at every 10-minute interval about what the state of affairs was the last 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So even though the internet is an untrusted network, you're not verifying the RSA fingerprints of everyone you communicate with, send Bitcoin to. It's an untrusted network, but you can still establish trust over it through this kind of blockchain technology. It's really amazing from a computer science perspective. And it has obviously enormous financial implications and legal implications and social implications and all of that. But I get to see the empirical reality of what people have theorized about, or what I've theorized about, right? That a new money emerging displacing another money.
Right.
Usually we only see it for the worse. There's something in economics called Gresham's Law, which states, you know, in its colloquial sense, that bad money drives out good money. What it really refers to is a certain fixed ratio of what the government sets the money to be versus what the market price of the money is. Anyway, in this case, it's actually the opposite. It's good money driving out bad money.
Yeah.
So the more people incorporate Bitcoin into their cash holdings, the more they use them for their payments, the more they use them for remittances or for savings or for settlements of people, for debts that they have or whatever, the more it will come to take a market-wide kind of character, kind of an activity. It becomes money, right? It begins as an asset, and then over time it becomes just a popular medium of exchange, and everyone's okay with dealing with it.
Right.
And that's something that emerged not by any plan or any design or any invention, you know, any kind of central plan. Some wizards get together and thought about this, although maybe they were wizards, actually. Maybe Satoshi was a group of wizards. But it is, you know, it's like I'm seeing in real time what theories that I've been studying that are being vindicated. And so when this continues to happen and Bitcoin takes over the internet, and it's currently doing, and it's taking over black markets around the world, this system D, this whole, you know, this economists have calculated or predicted or estimated that the worldwide total economic value of this whole system D, the whole worldwide agorist network, is in the tens of trillions of dollars.
Sure. Yeah, oh yeah.
It's massive. And there's a kind of a funny joke that in computer science or in the Bitcoin world, anything not built for the black market is not worth building. Anything that doesn't aid the black market, anything that doesn't aid the counter economy is going to be irrelevant in 5 years.
Sure.
Because okay. That's the growth of these. That's the growth of the agorist network. It's the growth of the worldwide black market network. So the next thing on the plate, you know, in the same vein, is going to be central banks and government fiat. So maybe Visa or MasterCard or PayPal or the developers at Ripple or whatever, they won't have the manpower or the leverage to stop themselves from becoming irrelevant. Maybe they'll try to stay relevant in certain ways. They'll try to reincorporate certain features to stay relevant.
Oh, they'll grab the state as a weapon and fight as long as they can.
Indeed, indeed. But that'll ultimately be a fight to the death, and it won't be Bitcoin that dies.
Right.
Bitcoin, the blockchain, as some people have remarked, the blockchain is immortal. The blockchain was born... what was it, January 2009 at some point, and it will probably live forever unless people voluntarily just detach from it and they choose a different coin with a different blockchain, and they, you know, it just orphans, it just stops.
Mm-hmm.
But if Bitcoin continues to be the money of use, then the blockchain is forever. And it's just funny thinking about all the tools, the tools and weapons the governments have at their disposal, all of the laws, all of the agents, all of the bureaus, all of the departments, all of the edicts and the regulations, all of the men and women in corporate America they've bought and purchased, all of the men in academia that they've bought and purchased.
Yeah.
The various class of protected interests, you can broadly describe them as. These are their weapons, and these are their men and their armies and whatever, and it is totally ineffective against Bitcoin.
Right.
You cannot silence Bitcoin. You cannot jail it. You cannot arrest it. You cannot shut down its servers. You can't block it. You can't censor it. You can't even adequately detect when people are using it. If it was one thing where it's like every time someone uses Bitcoin, we get a blinking light on this computer, and that tells us where the person is so we can go arrest them. That doesn't exist.
I
can use Bitcoin privately. I can use Bitcoin anonymously. I can have 100 different addresses with various amounts in them that nobody will know belong to me if I take good enough precautions.
Do you think there's still a danger about being very public as, you know, a mover or a significant figure in the Bitcoin world? I mean, I'm reminded, I know obviously it's very different, but I'm reminded of Prohibition, right? Like, you can't do anything about the demand for booze or marijuana.
Right, or guns.
But... you can, you know, identify people and you can target them and attack them.
Yeah.
And we've seen that happen. And not just people, but networks, even marketplaces.
Yep.
Built basically around Bitcoin, or people who were, you know, very public about their role in the development and growth of Bitcoin basically be targeted and attacked. As it becomes more accepted, that should dissipate.
Yeah.
But it's probably, I mean, we're still very, very much at the beginning of this.
So, okay, so I'll put it this way then. Bitcoin isn't a ghost.
Right.
You know, Bitcoin exists in as much as real flesh and blood people choose to use it.
Mm-hmm.
So if they can target the flesh and blood people using it, then they can injure Bitcoin, or they can put obstacles in front of the use of Bitcoin the purpose of the technology is to render that increasingly difficult. Mm-hmm. So what you're talking about when we're talking about marketplaces being attacked, we're talking about the Silk Road seizures, I presume we're talking about Mt. Gox falling, we're talking about various different kind of critical points in Bitcoin's history. But these are, in my opinion, these are the last lingering death throes of a dark, envious place.
Sure.
These are the last reaches of the tentacles of a dying monster. These are kind of the last death rattles, you know, that, you know, you've 6 seconds, you're about to die. What do you say? That's your death rattle. And that's kind of what's happening now. That there's this kind of hyper focus put on key players, that Charlie Shrem got arrested for getting connected to Silk Road for the order of $1 million, drug, you know, money laundering for drugs or whatever, whereas HSBC launders billions to Mexican drug cartels. Absolutely. And they get a slap on the wrist. So the deck is stacked, and they can target key people, and they can target key players, and they can make probably can make Amir Taki's life hell, they can probably arrest Cody Wilson, they can probably do a number of things to major players. But these systems that we're using are transitionary systems from the current world. So if you think that Amazon is revolutionary, it's really not. It's a centralized marketplace that exists on the internet, and it's cool, but it uses typical fiat money. It integrates perfectly with the credit card system. It's got a central issuer. They pay taxes. They record your identity. They do all of this stuff. You see marketplaces that are a step removed from that, like Silk Road, which was an Amazon for the crypto world, or an Amazon for the dark market, or the dark web, the deep web, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, and it solved certain problems, and that the media of exchange they were using was much more amenable to the transactions they were doing.
Right.
Using Bitcoin for drugs and for illicit, you know, for fake driver's licenses and for fake someone's hair, you know, items or whatever you want. Bitcoin's much more suitable to that than fiat money or credit cards, because those can be traced.
Right.
But the Silk Road still isn't perfection. It's not like the platonic form of the marketplace we want.
Right.
It was still run by a central server, central institution, by human beings, human intermediaries. It still existed on a vulnerable network, which is the Tor network. And so that was an iteration, and that fell. But that was the Napster.
Right. Exactly. Okay,
so
yeah.
There's iterations, and eventually what it becomes is it becomes a more pure expression of what crypto can bring, which is a full peer-to-peer marketplace, fully decentralized marketplaces, smart contracts and smart property, right? Contracts you issue on the blockchain that execute themselves, that are self-executing.
What would be an example of that? So now we're kind of getting into, just so we can label this, because this is how I wanted to wrap up, money was the first step for this technology.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about smart contracts, now we're getting into some of the other things that, you know, traditionally you need a third party, and the third party is the state.
Or central or commercial banks.
Exactly.
Or notaries, or any number of them.
So now all of these services or all of these arrangements are possible, or will be possible, outside of those traditional methods.
Sure.
So let's talk a little bit about smart contracts and self-execution of contracts.
Sure. So it doesn't seem implausible to me that many of the devices that we currently have in our homes will become smart.
Okay.
Will become a part of the internet, right? Mm-hmm. You've heard of the Internet of Things.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We have smartphones. We've got smart glass and tablets and various things like that. It doesn't seem implausible to me that at some point in the future, not only will your refrigerator be able to connect to the internet, and to download perhaps recipes, to download information, maybe to download images or ideas or talk to you or connect to forums or whatever, but it'll also hold Bitcoin holdings.
Yeah.
And it'll know when the refrigerator is running low on supplies, it'll purchase them automatically, and it'll send Bitcoin over the blockchain to another, you know, company that sells food or ships food or whatever. It'll automatically ship to you, and you won't need to go out of your way to manually purchase food anymore. One of the old jokes in the Bitcoin sphere is that on the blockchain, nobody knows you're a fridge.
Right.
So you can have all manner of appliances or contracts or stipulations that are self-executing, in the sense that the appliance or the machine that's got the Bitcoins is also programmed in such a way to spend them at regular intervals, or to spend them at predictable intervals.
Yeah.
It's not implausible to imagine a vending machine being a smart vending machine that receives input by Bitcoins, can detect when it's low, purchases supplies, and there's some guy with a truck that shows up every Wednesday just to fill it up.
Right.
But he doesn't know who the owner is. He doesn't, you know, He doesn't interface with it. He doesn't determine what it buys. He just fills it up. But the vending machine automatically continues sales. It continues receiving and continues doing these processes. And we start getting into cars. We start getting into ideas of smart property where I'm sending you the keys to this car and they're cryptographic keys. The car won't unlock unless it registers on the blockchain that you are now holder of these keys. And you might have like a little dongle on your keychain. You might have some kind of way of a biometric scan, perhaps.
Yeah.
But the car will recognize because it'll be constantly searching the blockchain. Who is the most recent owner of these keys? Who is the most recent owner of these keys? And then it changes hands.
Yeah.
Right. You sell me your car and I give you Bitcoin or something. Right. And suddenly you move the keys from your wallet onto one of my wallets. And suddenly now I control the keys to the car, the cryptographic keys, right? The private key. If you think of a car as like a wallet, kind of, you know, I can drive the car, I can spend from the car.
But the
car will unlock when it detects that, okay, now I'm in the presence of real keys that this person has, you know, is proven cryptographically to have acquired from the previous owner. I will now unlock for you. Doors, any kind of other security feature could operate that way.
So how about like a contract between two individuals? If there's actual Bitcoin value tied into the contract, if one party fails to honor the contract, does it just take?
It could. Depends on how the contract's structured.
Okay.
So there's plenty of ways in which contracts are now much more able to be programmed and engineered to specification than they were prior. So in a case where two people are trading and there's Bitcoin values involved, it doesn't seem unlikely to me that you'd involve an escrow.
Okay, so there goes lawyers, too.
Well, yeah, exactly, right. And it wouldn't mean an escrow as in having an undersigner or a notary or a cosigner.
Yeah.
It would mean an escrow in the sense of this transaction is taking place in a multi-sig wallet where to spend from it, you need two of three keys. You know,
right,
so I have a key, you have a key, and the escrow has a key, right? Mm-hmm. The escrow is just a contract in the blockchain. It'll just execute as soon as certain conditions are met. You know, as soon as these Bitcoin fall into this wallet, this escrow automatically releases the keys to the car, whatever, for instance, right?
Okay.
But that can be arranged. You can have two or three keys. You can have four or five keys. You can have, you know, you can have family wallets where you have seven keys, but any one of them are sufficient to spend from the wallet. Maybe you give your kids certain types of keys with certain restrictions on them. All this is possible with multi-signature addresses.
Yeah, this seems to be the one big obstacle. Like, I don't mind on eBay $30 to somebody else with the understanding that they're going to ship me something, you know, $30. I mean, I'd like to get the thing and I would go through the process, the restorative process if I didn't get the thing. It's $30, you know. So obviously I would be very reluctant to do larger transactions.
For $2,000 on eBay.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. But what you're talking about kind of over time would erase those fears.
Yeah, indeed. You wouldn't have to trust PayPal's fine print of their return policy, and you wouldn't have to send them emails after email after email, reaming them out and getting support and trying to get them to take your side, and you wouldn't have to, you know. So conversely, if you're a buyer or seller, you know, I know that PayPal is pretty bad for merchants because it allows consumers to charge back stuff that they've done fraudulently.
Yeah.
So PayPal will almost, in my understanding, I've used it kind of infrequently, but my understanding is that PayPal will almost always take the side of the consumer. So that puts a burden on the merchant now, because now they have to prove that they shipped it and insured it and it came and they signed, and they have to prove that there's no fault on their end of it. That, you know, they have to prove that the consumer is in error or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, you know, it's like the escrow, is, you know, PayPal in this case is the intermediary. They're governed by corporate policy. They're governed by governmental rules. They're governed by human self-interest.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Right? But you can't point a gun at a cryptographic equation. You can't point a gun at a hash function and tell it to, you know, to go the opposite way. It's a one-way function. You know, you can't apply government force or coercion. You can't, you know, human self-interest can't even seep into that.
Exactly.
It's a trustless system by default, or at least this is the idea of the kind of Bitcoin 2.0 technology, is to enable these types of trustless platforms and trustless exchanges.
Absolutely. Some of the other ones that you mentioned in the article, we discussed peer-to-peer marketplaces, gambling, decentralized exchanges, crowdfunding. Anything else that you think is worth going into that would excite people about the future of this?
Yeah, so things, I'm no fan of politics.
Sure.
I'm not even a fan of elections.
Okay.
You know,
agree.
elections, to me, my understanding of elections comes mostly from Mencken and Thoreau.
Elections
are an advance auction sale of stolen goods.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing Bitcoin can do is create provably fair elections. So you dish out digital tokens to each person. Each person gets one token.
Mm-hmm.
And they vote by sending a token to a different wallet. And you just see which wallet has the most votes at the end of the session or whatever.
Yeah.
You can't. There's no fraud. You can't insert multiple coins. Each person gets one coin, one vote. And you can look at the distribution of votes in real time. That's interesting, too. Rather than, like, casting your vote, and I don't know how many people want this guy or how many people want this guy. As you're voting, you could have real-time updates on what the kind of blockchain has to say about which candidate has this many votes, right? So you can make it provably fair in the sense that here you can see at the very beginning of the mining pool, we pre-mined 10 million of them, and we received 9,800,000. You know, some people received them but didn't want to vote or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, like, there's definitely not more voted than we issued to begin with. You know, you could prove that using blockchain analysis.
So this topic of elections brings up a faith in humanity question, mm-hmm. that I want to ask you. Do you, I mean, right now you said maybe worldwide 3-4 million people using Bitcoin. What do you think it would take? I mean, we discussed what it would take for interested parties, you know, in commerce to accept, embrace, start using Bitcoin. What do you think for the average American it will take? Do you think we're already down the road in the process to getting the average American, you know, cable news watching, voting, tax paying,
the Fox News citizen, watching,
the good citizen,
the good, the upstanding citizen,
to embrace Bitcoin.
That's a process of overcoming their initial prejudices.
Mm-hmm.
That's the process. So I like to think of Bitcoin immersion as like a 7-stage thing, where it's like stage one is like no one, you've never even heard of Bitcoin before. You know, believe it or not, there are still some people out there who have never heard of Bitcoin before.
Yeah.
And, you know, you say, hey, have you heard of Bitcoin? Do you know anything about it? Do you have any Bitcoin? And they're a blank slate. You know, their mind is a tabula rasa regarding Bitcoin. They have no input one way or the other. And you tell them a little bit about it, and here's how it works. And perhaps they come away with a prejudice, or they come away with some idea. But then you have those who see it on the news, who read it in newspapers, who hear Paul Krugman disparage Bitcoin, who hear about it from their friends, or they, or, you know, Mt. Gox lost $1 billion. Haha, what funny internet money. What are these nerds going to do next?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have stage two, stage three, and so forth. But it's all about overcoming that initial prejudice. It's all about taking what people already know about Bitcoin, or what they've heard, or what they think they know, and explaining to them or showing them that, no, it actually works this way. Here's why it's cool. I can do this with it. You can't do this with your money.
Right, right.
Here's what I can do. Here's magic that costs, you know, 10% with Western Union and it takes 3 days. Or it costs this amount to go through Visa and they eat 3%. Or I have to sign up and give my firstborn and blood and a marrow sample to the state to use, you know, the SWIFT banking network or the ACH, the Automated Clearinghouse Banking Network, to send money to whatever. I can do this on my phone in 2 seconds.
Yeah, it's also interesting to see this kind of this battle that I think will intensify between elements of our training through things like school, obedience and conformity.
Yeah.
Right. Versus self-interest. Right. Well, you talked about what's happening in some more socialist countries in South America. Right. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, well, this isn't an option. You know, we're not agorists as activists. We need to do this to survive. And even if people here in the near future don't have to do it to actually survive, the volume of their self-interest versus the obedience and conformity training, self-interest might just win out.
Yeah.
Like, I can't afford to do anything else anymore.
Hopefully it will win out. And that's kind of the point of us trying to like educate people about Bitcoin and why it's valuable.
Mm-hmm.
But see, just having to educate them, having to talk to people multiple times, having to get them interested in some kind of internet, you know, niche corner of the internet with this digital money with weird doges and weird other things on the labels and weird stuff. That we're already at a disadvantage in the United States.
Yeah.
Because it's not so pressing. That's what I tell people. When you're waiting for the Bitcoin revolution, it's not going to be here. It's not going to be in the US. It's not going to be in Canada. It won't be in, well, maybe in Canada, but it won't be in the Western Hemisphere as far as I can tell currently. It'll be where people really, really see and need the value proposition.
Right.
The West is inundated with credit and banking options, plenty of liquidity, plenty of micro lending. Everyone, most everyone has a bank account. Everyone has access to credit cards. Everyone has access to ATMs.
Mm-hmm.
Right. This is the exception, not the rule of the rest of the world.
Right.
So what's another little internet niche money that's entering the field when I've got my TD Bank ATM machine down the street and I can pay by credit anywhere I go to and my credit's equally good anywhere and I've got all this plethora. If I want to get a car loan, I can do that. If I want to get a home loan, I can do that. If I want to get schooling, you know, loan for higher schooling, I can do that. All these, you know, multifarious loan options. Credit at my disposal, and the government backstops my property. You know, the government backstops what I, you know, I own this. I own the things I say I own, and they're going to defend my interests. Whatever. In many countries of the world, they do not do this. It's just not possible. The people have either their own crappy fiat money, and they're in a bubble because their government doesn't recognize them in their title to goods, so they can't get into international scenes. This is kind of DeSoto's point. They're kind of landlocked in their own country's trading markets. Where they're put under by their government, they're taken advantage of by their government. Their position is exploited. But with Bitcoin, that's no longer necessary. It's no longer necessary to prove that you are who you say you are before you can spend money.
Mm-hmm.
Now you can just push any amount of money to anyone in the world, as long as you have a hash of their public key, as long as you have where it's going to.
Right. Right.
So, you know, this is not, you know, this is innovative and it's amazing. And it's friends who I talk to here think it's cool, but they only think it's cool. They only think it's neat. They're not wowed. It's not like I can save 20% by sending money to my family in Kenya.
Yeah.
I don't have to deal with Western Union anymore. Or I can take Bitcoin as a cabbie, you know, and I don't have to deal with all the credit card stuff and Square and all the money handling I have to do. I can just have a QR code on the back panel and they can pay me and be out and it's secured and it's mine and I can spend that without anybody looking over what I'm spending, without anybody even knowing perhaps that I have it.
Right.
That's enormously valuable in many countries around the world that are not so, suffice to say, decadent with money, with credit and lending options as we are in the States. So I don't have a whole lot of optimism that the United States will spearhead the worldwide Bitcoin, you know, explosion. I think it'll probably be China, or it'll probably be in other parts of the world that they tremendously need it more than we do.
Yeah.
I want to get people involved in Bitcoin earlier rather than later, certainly.
Yeah.
I want them just like I think it's better for people to have email earlier rather than later. I don't know a single person that doesn't have an email address.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know a single person that doesn't have a phone number.
So essentially, necessity will drive the evolution. And here in the United States, it will either be people who want to engage in gray or black markets, or maybe people who see this as a kind of activism, right? When you're using Bitcoin, I mean, this goes without saying, this is like one of the most basic things we could talk about, but you're turning your back on an entire system, a very convenient system,
yep.
But it is entirely backed by reliance on state power.
Yeah, absolutely. You're not using their money.
Right.
And as my friend Rob Mathias says, that's the crucial point for Bitcoin to him. He doesn't have a bank account.
Right.
He rejects getting a bank account on the principle that he doesn't want to use their money. He has to cash his checks at like obscure check cashing places and take like exorbitant interest, you know, exorbitant fees on it or whatever, because he's just committed to not having a bank account. And that's the sticking point for him. It's not their money. You're not funding the slaughtering of people around the world for it. You're not paying Barney Frank.
Yeah.
You're not paying these corrupt political leaders that are almost like Roman senators at this point.
Mm-hmm.
These opulent men with mansions that rule over, that tower over everyone else in the country. You're not paying for money to go to war contractors. You're not paying for people into the gigantic welfare state. You're not paying for CPS. You're not paying for all of these things that are fundamentally opposed to what many Bitcoin users think of as you know, these are trappings of a slave society.
Yeah.
That we are perpetually sheared like sheep and exploited to fund a war machine that dominates three quarters of a globe. That we're coerced into paying for a prison system that incarcerates more per capita than anywhere else in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That we're forced into paying a system that encourages cultural dependence and intergenerational warfare with the welfare state.
Yeah, yeah.
We're not paying for our children to be brainwashed and mentally destroyed.
Yeah, otherwise we would know the lessons of where the warfare welfare state goes.
Right.
History's written them already.
So that's the point of not using their money, that you're not buying into that paradigm, you're not supporting it, you're not giving your sanction to it, as Rand would say. You're not, you know, a kidnapped victim reluctantly agreeing to undertake, you know, small services of people who kidnap you just so they stop beating you.
Mm-hmm.
You are using an independent money that I don't feel like I'm giving sanction to my exploiters.
Right.
You know, I am denying them that. I'm entering into a new economy, a new economic system that denies from them spoils that they don't earn, that they don't deserve, and that they employ violence against others to take.
Yeah.
It's an opt-out. You know, that's what it is. It's an opt-out of that whole kind of slavery, bondage, tax slavery arrangement.
Absolutely. So look, we ran a little long today, but it's a good thing we did. This was one of the most educational shows I can remember doing.
Cool.
I have to say, that's saying quite a bit. This is an educational podcast.
Excellent.
So thank you so much, Mateus. And where can people learn more about you and consume your work if they wish?
The major outlets for some of my thinking now are Bitcoin Magazine. So you can check out some of my author archives at Bitcoin Magazine. You may still find me on Facebook. I don't add friends very often, but I will talk to anyone who talks to me.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, I've got some kind of horrible pretensions of doing a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
But who does those? Especially here in New Hampshire, who does those? But I'm online. I'm on Twitter and LinkedIn and various kind of media. So anyone who tries hard enough to find me usually does, you know, a fine job of it.
Yeah, and if they just want to start out by reading your stuff, search your name. It will be in the show notes on Bitcoin Magazine, Mises, Economic Journal.
Economic Thought.
Economic Thought, yep. I'm sorry, yep. Great, thank you so much. And there's plenty for us to talk about, and we're neighbors, so I can definitely have you back in the
cool.
future.
Glad to have you here in Manchester, finally.